audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Network. Today on Sprouts, we report from Pacifica Network reporters from across the country who worked with us to describe some of the things that happened in their states on election night and some of the feelings and reasons behind these events. We start with the younger end of the voter spectrum, going to Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington.
My name is Flynn Rodriguez, and I'm the public affairs producer at KUGS-FM Bellingham, Washington, up on the northern border. And here in Washington, many voters are overwhelmingly voting in favor of Kamala Harris, which is unsurprising, given the history of us as a blue state. The Senate looks like it's going to Cantwell, and the governor to Bob Ferguson once again. Bob Ferguson is with the Democratic Party, and Maria Cantwell is also with the Democratic Party as well. I have some things to say about the general influences on how Bellingham voters are feeling about the presidential election. I'd say that the general sentiment here is that there's hope for a Harris win, but there isn't a rallying support for her, and more so a desire to just not see another 4 years of Trump in office. And neither Trump nor Harris are giving many young voters what they really want, which is a United States call for ceasefire in Gaza and the immediate halt of all weapons and military funding sent to Israel. Neither candidate will condemn the genocide of the Palestinian people, and their continued stance of allyship with Israel is very much being seen as a blatant endorsement of this ongoing atrocity. Many here feel that Harris's democratic values are coming off as very performative, as she takes a stance as someone who is for the young voter and for the marginalized, but continues to stand behind Israel, which seems to be a very clear display of her unwillingness to really listen to young people, which I have heard from many around me has left them feeling gross and frustrated with the options given us this election. And as for Bellingham's cultural identity, which I would say ripples out to most of the West Coast of Washington, we are very liberal and very left-leaning here. And our city council unanimously called for a ceasefire in Gaza in December of last year. So it's a feeling that's shared generationally. There was an encampment on Western Washington University's campus this spring in support of Palestine. That momentum has not gone away at all. And Bellingham has seen a huge movement in community action to put pressure on our local government and our university administration to act for the people they represent. And Bellingham has also seen a fostering of community of people coming together in our grief and our anger to embody a way of being that leans on our family and friends and neighbors through mutual aid and community spaces that are acknowledging our raw human vulnerability now more than ever. And I'd say that that's something that no ballot could ever fully represent. So we're hoping for the safety that a Democratic win could provide for us as we continue to navigate what it looks like to ensure that our voices are listened to. And we also have a overwhelmingly large queer community here. And I think that there's a lot of fear around the anti-trans rhetoric that Trump has been running his campaign on. And same goes for the abortion laws that are being put under scrutiny. And many of us are just scared about what 4 years could look like under Trump. And for many of us young student voters, it's our first time filling out a ballot, and it's a bleak introduction to adulthood. So it's somber and tense as we all await the results. A big measure that's on the ballot in Washington this year is 2117, which would prohibit state agencies from imposing any type of carbon tax credit trading and repeal legislation, establishing a cap and invest program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It would decrease funding for investments in transportation, clean air, renewable energy, conservation, and emissions reduction. Many people here feel that the inaction of this measure would be truly just catastrophic for the environment and a huge hit to the progress that has been made towards environmental restoration and conservation. Everything is really at risk here. Our clean air, water, soil. It would dramatically affect indigenous communities by getting rid of really important project funding and putting more pressure on already stressed communities and systems. And overall, many Washingtonians are just adamantly against this measure and see no benefit in it and are really outraged that it's being proposed at all in a state that benefits and loves its land so much. So there's been a lot of rallying for voting no on 2117. Measure 2066 also falls under this category of prohibition of certain laws and regulations around natural gas use. And it just generally feels like a huge step backwards in these environmental advocacy spaces and just for humanity's well-being as a whole. So that's what's on all of our minds is autonomy and the environment. So it is anxious in Bellingham tonight. My name is Flynn Rodriguez, and I'm the public affairs producer at KUGS FM Bellingham, Washington, up on the northern border. Thank you.
As part of Pacifica Network's election night coverage, Dr. Julian Malveaux of WPFW in Washington, D.C., spoke with election campaigners in southern Georgia about rural voters.
And so we have Marion Gaines Jones, lead organizer with the Southwest Georgia Education and Voter Registration Campaign. You know, we always think about Atlanta and Augusta, the big cities, but you've been focusing on some of the rural areas. What are we missing when we focus on the big cities and not the rural areas?
Well, you're missing those votes, you know.
There you go.
First, you're missing those votes. Most people in rural counties do vote. And that's what I was seeing on my tips, that they're actually getting out to the polls, the young, the olders, and the in-between, that 35, 17 and a half, 35 age range that we've been targeting. So it's been a great turnout in all of the counties that I visited in Kanda.
Well, you know, Marion, what do rural people care about that we urban people don't pay attention to? Give me one issue that they care about more than we do.
I'm so glad you asked that question. The cost of living is a big issue. Just being able to survive, that's an issue in rural counties in Georgia. What we realize that most of those persons that are working, most of them may not be high school or college graduates. So when you look at the income ratio, still have minimum wage jobs here. And particularly in rural counties where they're building all of those dollar trees, dollar stores, you know they don't pay any money. And we're talking about custodians, bus drivers who are always underpaid, but their services are so valuable.
The cost of living is a big thing for rural folks because basically they don't have the employment opportunities that others do. Marion, you have been such a wonderful resource. Marion Gaines Jones, joining from Georgia, organizer, thank you so very much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
That was Julianne Malveaux of WPFW in Washington, D.C., reporting on voting politics in Georgia. In Sarasota, WSLR reports on the historic moment when Florida, a swing state, stopped swinging.
I'm Johannes Werner. I'm news director at WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota, Florida. We just reemerged from a landslide here. Florida is solidly in the Trump camp, and the preliminary statewide count shows 56% for Trump. Florida does not look at all like a swing state anymore. Republican candidates won up and down Miami-Dade County, and that used to be a Democratic stronghold. There was very high turnout in early voting, possibly record-setting turnout. Lines were really long in the past weeks here, and it's obvious the Republicans have caught up and beat Democrats in what used to be their ground game. In early in-person voting, Republicans exceeded Democrats by a million this time, and that's a complete shift. I think it's mostly due to culture war and the successful waging of culture wars. I think it's a function of culture wars. The Republicans have successfully positioned themselves as warriors on issues that are quite popular here. They framed, for example, school board races in terms of parental rights. We're the most extremist county here, I would say, in Florida. That's Sarasota County. This is where a lot of these extreme ideas have been hatched. There's beginning to be a pushback here. And amazingly, two moderate candidates were elected to that school board in the primaries this summer, in the non-party elections this summer. The Florida Democrats best hopes just before the election was to break the Republican supermajority in the state legislature, which has made possible an avalanche of conservative laws in the past legislative session, but it doesn't look at all like this is going to happen. The biggest disappointment for activists here are the constitutional amendments. That's the citizen-initiated Amendment 3, which would have legalized recreational use of marijuana. And then there's Amendment 4, which would have anchored the right to access abortion in the Florida Constitution. There was a lot of energy, and they mobilized a lot of young people. The petition gatherers easily exceeded the signatures they needed, and both amendment campaigns have raised more than $100 million each. But in response, Governor Ron DeSantis has blatantly used taxpayer funds and the state's institutions to campaign against both. And the outcome is both amendments got majorities, but the marijuana amendment has clearly fallen short of the 60% they needed at 55.75%, and the abortion amendment landed at 57%. There is some progressive energy in the state. There were two interesting races for state attorney in the Orlando and Tampa Bay area. Both Monique Worrell and Andrew Warren had been fired by Governor Ron DeSantis, and they were both running to get their jobs back. And Monique Worrell actually won. She managed that with a whopping 57%. She is in Orlando, and Orlando is kind of a counter story to Miami-Dade. And that story is driven by progressive candidates. There is U.S. Representative Maxwell Frost, who cruised to re-election with 62% of the vote. And then there's Anna Escamani. She's a progressive leader in the Florida House. She easily won re-election with 58%. One of the observations I would like to add here is the issues here for working people. Florida is a low-wage, mean state. Life is really tough for working people. The legislature has passed extreme anti-labor laws recently, but there is pushback now. Teamsters have celebrated major organizing victories in Florida this year, particularly in our neck of the woods here in Southwest Florida. UPS workers in this region were picketing this summer. Even bank tellers here are unionizing right now, as are Starbucks baristas. And that's quite a big deal in this low-wage service economy here. The biggest deal, though, is the pushback by teachers' unions. They were the main political target of all this anti-union legislation. They now have to get 60% of eligible workers to vote for a union if they want to recertify. But the teachers' unions managed to do that with flying colors this year. So most of the recertifying votes in this region and in some of the biggest school districts in Florida was above 80%. How that newly found energy translates into electoral politics all remains to be seen. And then there's the issue of overdevelopment. That's how it's defined here. The sprawling suburbs and big hotels and luxury condos that get built are the biggest concern of residents in this area. It's creating conflict within Republican strongholds here in Southwest Florida. There's the case of Manatee County, where the MAGA base, for instance, just flushed out a complete set of county commissioners they had just elected in the last cycle, and it's all over development and overdevelopment. And that mixes with three hurricanes that hit this area recently, plus two major flooding events. So climate change is, whether Republicans call it that way or not, seeping into Republican politics here. And the overdevelopment fears are tied into fears of flooding now and anxiety over disappearing agriculture and food security. So that's an interesting development we're watching very closely here. Johannes Werner, News Director at WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota, Florida.
In West Virginia, not a lot of surprises, although a lawsuit over ballot integrity is in development in Mingo County.
Hello, I'm Roy Clark from WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia. Some projections here from the Associated Press. Republican Donald Trump is projected to win West Virginia, and for the U.S. Senate, seat of retiring Joe Manchin, Republican Jim Justice, the current governor of West Virginia, is projected to win. And for the U.S. House districts in District 1, Raleigh Moore, Republican, is expected to win. In West Virginia District 2, Carol Miller, the incumbent Republican House representative. And the AP also projects that Republican Patrick Morrissey will also be the next governor of West Virginia. Those are all the major federal and state races in West Virginia. It's been a pretty peaceful day as far as elections in West Virginia as is concerned. It's running like a well-oiled machine, someone from the Secretary of State's office said earlier today. I haven't heard of any major discrepancies or anything. The turnout in West Virginia was higher than average for West Virginia. And looking at some of the percentages here for the president, 62%. That's quite a bit. Still kind of wondering about that 6th district state senate race down there in Mingo County, which is quite unusual, where there is now a lawsuit that has been filed by the ACLU over ballot integrity, and the candidate that's qualified to run was left off the ballot for 5 days of early voting. So the qualified Democrat candidate was left off the ballot for the state senator's race in District 6. But the Republicans in that county outnumbered the Democrats in Mingo County by 1,700. That makes you wonder. It's going to be interesting to watch that one play out. I'm Roy Clark, WEFR AM 1700 in Fairmont, West Virginia.
Debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. Today on Sprouts, Pacifica Network reporters from around the country describing some of the things that happened in their states on election night and some of the feelings and reasons behind them. We heard from Washington State, Washington, D.C., Georgia, Florida, and West Virginia. In Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN monitors voting day problems and credits poll workers for their steadfast commitment.
I'm Brian Beal, host and producer of the American Democracy Minute, a daily news report on democracy issues from WNHN in Concord, New Hampshire. Credit the few number of problems November 5th to our hero election officials and poll workers, who, despite 4 years of threats and harassment, made sure our election was safe and secure, like they always have. We chronicled the biggest issues in our November 8th report. State and federal election officials term most problems encountered in the November 5th presidential election as routine, with quickly discredited bomb threats and ballot shortages among the worst issues of the day. The hoax bomb threats, which the FBI quickly traced to a Russian domain, briefly affected some precincts in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Most locations were operational in less than an hour. In Fulton County, Georgia, 32 precincts received threats, according to the Associated Press. In Cumbria County, Pennsylvania, a ballot printing issue prevented reading by the optical scanners, according to the New York Post. Working ballots arrived by 1:15 and were used for the remainder of the day. Polling hours were extended due to the problem. In Boston, WBUR reports that the Massachusetts Secretary of State is investigating ballot shortages in 5 to 10 precincts. The state had provided adequate ballots, but apparently city election officials didn't distribute all that was allocated to the precincts and didn't answer the phone when the calls came in for more. In Milwaukee, access panels to power and USB ports on some optical ballots readers were unsecured when over 30,000 of the over 106,000 absentee ballots were tabulated, according to VoteBeat. The panels were secured, the machines reset, and the affected ballots were rerun. You'll note we didn't mention widespread voter fraud in our November 8th report. There wasn't any this year or in 2020, thanks again to the professionalism of the nation's poll workers. Reporting for Sprouts and the Pacifica Radio Network, I'm Brian Beal.
In Texas, Jim Ellinger gives figures for election night, including the much-touted Senate race between Colin Allred and Ted Cruz.
Good evening. This is Jim Ellinger with Austin Airways reporting from the historic Driscoll Inn in downtown Austin, Texas. It was a sour evening for Texas Democrats. They had hoped that Ted Cruz, sometimes described as the most hated man in the United States Senate, and many people remember him taking a vacation in Cancun as Texas suffered the worst ice storm in a generation, leaving 200-plus Texans dead. Ted Cruz has been reelected rather handily against Colin Allred, former U.S. congressman and Texas football star, only did so-so, not as well as the skateboarding Beto O'Rourke of a few years ago. Again, Colin Allred, had he won, could have changed the United States Senate from Republican to Democrat. A well-known and very progressive Austin area congressman, Loy Doggett and Greg Kassar, won their reelections handily. In the city of Austin, where housing had become a growing issue, incumbent Mayor Kirk Watson, who had raised $1 million, rather handily beat all his five opponents and avoided a runoff by pulling more than 50% of the vote. Perhaps not surprising, in Texas, NBC and MSNBC called Texas for Trump very early on, and District Attorney Jose Garza, a very progressive man who had battled with the Austin Police Department and their many recalcitrant officers, won by more than 70% and showed strong support for reining in the Austin Police Department. All in all, it was a sour evening for Texas Democrats.
That was Jim Ellinger reporting from Austin, Texas. Another report from Texas concerns a judiciary race in the Houston area that has national implications about election funding. Daniel J. Cohen reported this to Pacifica's Houston station, KPFT. Cohen is with an advocacy group called Indivisible Houston. They describe themselves as a coalition to fight the rise of tyranny in America. He's speaking with KPFT's host, Egberto Willis.
There's this pact called Stop Houston Murders, and it's propped up by large, wealthy donors, but its single largest donor, they gave it $650,000 out of the $2 to $3 million of its raise estimated based on what it spent through Election Day. Also, raises a lot of money based off of these billionaires and household names. So that PAC, the Judicial Fairness PAC, raised $8.3 million or spent $2.3 million. It's a little complicated, but actually, there was $1 million that was given by Kenneth Morris Idris. He's a billionaire financial guy. There's $1 million given by Hillwood Development. And then PRT Holdings, Apache Corporation, ConocoPhillips, Jeffrey Hildebrand, another billionaire, Chevron America, not to mention a bunch of other major corporations and major money people have given money to this PAC. And they run this narrative that says, Stop Houston Murders, and they run a completely false anti-scientific narrative on how the bond system actually works. But the thing is, as much as they run on defeating criminal judges, what they really are hoping happens is that people go and vote on judges, whether they're criminal or civil, because all those corporations and companies that I just mentioned want to win their civil lawsuits so they don't have to pay restitution to people who they poison and otherwise kill with their derelict duty, monopolistic corporate greed. So that's really what's going on. It's extremely sinister because if you think about it, the groups I just named, real estate, big finance, and big oil are getting involved in judicial races and using a false narrative on law and justice or justice and safety or whatever you want to call it so that they can win civil suit. So it's a really nasty trend, extremely corrosive to democracies. The most sophisticated version of the dark money scam that we've seen in maybe any election cycle so far. And they deploy it here in Harris County, and it was effective. We're going to see what happens. I do think a lot of Democratic judges are going to pull it out. So I think the ones that got attacked, probably a lot of them will survive. But a lot of these races are closer than they should have been. They probably aren't going to be effective enough in the DA's race, but it's closer than it should have been. And the Court of Appeals races look pretty tenuous in terms of what the outcomes are going to be. So it's been a rather effective and nasty and, frankly, evil and villainous tactic.
I'm looking down the list of races in the judiciary, and this is not just local to Houston or Harris County. This is something that is playing all over the country.
The way that funders have invested in elections, if those funders truly care about winning these races, then you can't just write $90 million in checks in $2,800 or $5,000 at a time to a candidate that's going to spend the majority of it on airtime, and it's going to go up and slope for the rest of time when you could have taken literally $1 million of those dollars and probably bailed out a whole slate of judges. Or at least even if you had taken, you know, $2 or $3 million, let's say I'm wrong, you need more money. $2 or $3 million out of $90 million that gets spent on some of these big statewide races could have bailed a lot of these judges out. You're talking about a wide range of both criminal and civil cases that the Court of Appeal is going to rule on, which means whether or not women live or die based on whether or not they need an abortion, as well as workers' rights, as well as immigration cases, as well as big business cases, and whether or not they're allowed to poison the air and water. All of that is going to be decided by these Court of Appeals races across 10 counties. And it would have been worth peeling off just a small amount of that statewide money that goes basically up in smoke. There's no infrastructure left. It was all spent on big airtime plays. If you just hire organizers and you build long-lasting institutional movement-based work, then you can prevent a lot of these losses from happening. But I think that that knowledge and education isn't really common in the U.S. at this point. We love to revere Martin Luther King. We only read one of his speeches. And then in addition to that, nobody learns how to do what he does. There's nowhere in your school that they teach you about power and political organizing. There are a lot of voters, particularly there's a lot of white guys, okay, I'm going to be direct, who voted for Obama, Trump, and then Biden. But I imagine some of them went back to Trump at least. So they flip and flop around. I don't think people are bad. I think people, by and large, are good. What I mean by that is when people saw families getting separated and they saw all of those ICE detention facilities, they didn't like it. Viscerally, they opposed it. But they couldn't imagine it, and they can't get their head around it, as opposed to seeing them tangibly. And so when this guy says mass deportations, I think if those people really saw what that really means, that you kick down a fence in the middle of your buddy's barbecue while you're all watching NFL football and drag dad off to a facility and tear him away from his kid, I think that they would be horrified. But I think they can't crystallize what the actual outcome is going to be in their head. I think we'll see what happens at the national level, but I think to some degree that's happened when Roe was overturned. Some women finally threw out a lot of the other issues and said, okay, well, I'm just voting on that. Like, I can see it now. Now we're having women dying because they can't get access to care. It's real direct fear about someone who you know. The same way that when people's kids started coming out of the closet, then people's minds on gay marriage started to change. So I think that people vote against their own interests. And I think that the reason that that happens is if you are not extremely politically active, then you don't necessarily read the outcome before it's going to happen, because they can't understand how these things are going to impact their interests because they're not political.
Thank you so kindly for giving us your expertise here. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And that's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Pacifica Network reporters across the country describing some of the things that happened in their states on election night and some of the feelings and reasons behind them. Our contributors this week include member stations KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, WPFW in Washington, D.C., WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia, WNHN in Concord, New Hampshire, and KPFT in Houston, Texas. This week's Sprouts was produced by Lisa Loving, Ursula Rudenberg, and Stephanie Schubert. Music you heard included Wake Up America by Robert Wickline. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe, coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg from Pacifica Network. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
This is FM 90.1, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Ginger Nichols, and you are now listening to Radioactive. From 6:30 to 7:30, you're rolling with me. I'm on the mic, I'm on the music, and I got some special guests for you guys, so you're going to want to stay tuned. But not yet. Here first is Supercut by Lorde. Stay tuned, please enjoy, and don't forget, you're listening to KZFR.
I play a supercut of us, all the magic we gave off, all the love we had and lost. And in my head, the visions never stop. These ribbons wrap me up, but when I reach for you, there's just a supercut. In your car, the radio up. In your car, the radio up. We keep trying to talk about us. I'm someone you may be my love. I'll be your quiet afternoon crush. Be your violent overnight rush. Make you crazy over my touch. But it's just a supercut of us.